Hello and welcome to UC Today. My name's David Dungay. Today we have another big UC News show for you, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Rob Scott, Zias Caravalla, ZK Research, welcome to the show, Don Black from Covell Group, welcome, Evan Kerstell, Mr. Social Media himself, and of course, Erwin Lazar from Metrigy. Welcome everyone, I hope you're well.
Doing great.
Good for great. A Friday.
Fantastic. So I'm going to hand it over to my co-host today. We've got some great stories to talk about. Rob, what's first on the agenda?
Well, David, it's been another big month in the world of UC. So let's start with a big brand, Zoom. Zoom released their financial results, as did a few others. But Zoom, very, very interesting news. One part of that was Zoom Phone, significant growth, now 10% of their quarterly revenue. So let's dig a little bit deeper on that, but there's more to that story. David, what did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. This was a bit of an interesting one for Zoom. Obviously, the backdrop to this earnings call was the big financial challenges, shall we say, or restructuring that they did earlier in the year / last year. That's where we saw 1,300 staff being laid off. We saw Eric Yuan, CEO himself, took a 98%-ish or so pay cut. So these were really interesting figures. But the headlines are revenue, $1.1 billion. But that important stat in there, as you mentioned, Rob, Zoom Phone now makes up 10% or just over 10% of their quarterly revenues, which I thought was incredibly interesting. Some of those have come from big deals. We've seen Virginia Tech and Venture. There were about 10,000 Zoom Phone seats just themselves. So they're obviously getting some really big customers under that brand now. So that's pretty interesting to see. So not a bad state of affairs for Zoom as a whole. And the forward-looking kind of statement from Zoom is there's going to be some growth, not very much, but fairly stable for this kind of year and economic environment we're in. So pretty good on the whole. So I'm going to throw that over to Dom now. Dom, what do you think of these Zoom results? How significant is that Zoom Phone kind of statistic in there?
I think, Zoom Phone's been around since start of January 2019 when it was launched. So from a UCaaS offering point of view, it's one of the newer entrants, let's say, and to get to over 4 million users, I think it was midway through last year that they announced that. We've seen phenomenal growth on the Zoom Phone proposition. You see throughout the Zoom organization as well, the emphasis they put on Zoom Phone, and more recently Contact Center, and wrapping that around the Zoom one as well. So I'm not surprised its revenue is as significant as it is, but I think the real story is how quickly that adoption has come through Zoom Phone throughout the whole portfolio. I think one of the things that really stands out to me as well is we see a lot of the UCaaS providers now focusing on our contact center and trying to change their strategy around that as well. Zoom Phone's 10% of their revenue now. What's contact center going to be? Is it going to have that uptake as well? And how fast is that going to grow within the Zoom portfolio? I think it's a really key question that I'm looking at.
Yeah, I want to just add stuff in. When Zoom first launched Phone, the competitive chatter was that Zoom Phone really couldn't stand up to its competitors as far as the features and function standpoint. And what I've been impressed with is how fast they closed that gap. I was talking to the CIO of a law firm, and they're considering, and there's no, he told me that 7 of the top 10 US law firms all now run Zoom Phone. And that's an interesting metric because there are few industries that are as telephony heavy as legal, right? So if they can support the needs of that industry, they can really support the needs of any industry. So they have done a nice job becoming a full-featured phone company. This next year is going to be a very interesting one for Zoom because a lot of their COVID contracts are coming up for renewal, right? And I do know that the company's feeling a lot of pressure, right, trying to get those renewed. With the rise of Microsoft Teams, there's not as much addressable market as there was. And so Zoom's ability to renew those customers, but then also tack on things like Zoom Phone, Zoom Contact Center, sell the whole Zoom One suite will go a long way into getting people to think of them as something other than a video company.
Yeah, I'll jump in real quick. I think it just shows that they're executing on their need. In fact, I would say more so than just desire to extend their portfolio. So obviously we all know Zoom is a video conferencing company. That's where their bread and butter has been for the last few years. But the fact that now they are showing tangible revenue in voice, and we see it in our research that the percentage of folks in our studies that are using Zoom Phone are continuing to increase. We're starting to see Zoom gain some traction in the contact center space. You know, there has been this argument when you talk to organization leaders that, well, you know, I just get it from Microsoft for free, so therefore, why would I even think about a third party? But in the research that we've done, we've shown that Microsoft is still a significantly more expensive solution, especially on the voice side, to operate and administer. So if you can show that the operational cost for Zoom is even lower, then you kind of obviate that argument that it's free, because the free part may just look at the license or just adding calling into an existing platform, but it doesn't necessarily look at the operational cost and cost of telephony and so on that in many cases can be cheaper in the Zoom world.
Yeah, it's the most expensive free product out there, right? I will say the one thing that Zoom has that nobody else has in this industry is the pull in from the user community. I think, you know, even though they have so many contracts coming up, you know, a lot of those were sold during the pandemic, it got everybody used to using Zoom. You know, lawyers, doctors, people that never used video systems before, right? And so
it became a verb, right? So
yeah,
that's
yeah.
One of those few brands that became a verb.
Yeah. And so I do think that that's going to provide a kind of an interesting competitive dynamic for them, because more and more when I talk to CIOs, they are actually taking input from users as to what they want, which is not something that they did even 5 years ago.
It's great to see. And they also made an acquisition recently, didn't they? As they continue to really double down on the contact center and building out the whole Zoom portfolio. It seems really, really interesting.
I mean, contact center is incredibly important for all these companies. If you know, Teams is going to continue to roll in with their free offering. I think it, you know, more and more, if you look at Zoom One, the bundle, right, they rolled out email calendar, they included it in the license. So with unified communications, it seems you have to keep innovating to keep your price point the same. Contact centers, you know, revenue, you know, average revenue per user, their ARPU is much higher than UC. And more and more I'm seeing companies giving contact center seats to non-contact center agents. And so when you look at the increase, you know, the increase in the number of seats, and plus the fact that those, you know, you get more revenue per user for contact center, I think it's obvious why every UC vendor wants in that space, right? There's just a lot of money there.
I think it's an obvious space for them to move into, but yeah, Whether they're actually going to be able to sell that, I think, is a different story. We see a lot of people moving towards it and going, oh, we've got the same route to market, we'll sell through them. And you've got a lot of resellers and partners on the other side and agents who are going, we know how to sell UC, but contact center is way more complicated. And I think the company that makes it easy to be adopted are going to be the ones who are successful in this, pushing that through. I agree with your point as well on the UC users taking contact center now. That informal contact center market is enormous. We're seeing that uptake, SMEs upwards as well of adopting those services. So huge opportunities there for Zoom and others as well.
I suppose what's interesting is, can Zoom do to contact center what it did to video? And that's just make it uncomplicated. So I'll hang that out there. Let that marinate for a little bit. Let's move on to the next story.
So Rob, what's next on the agenda?
Okay, so hot on the heels of Channel Partners Expo and Conference. We met up with the CEO of Avaya, and they've been in the news a lot recently. So we wanted to kind of cover the kind of latest and greatest headlines on the Avaya bankruptcy process. So, David, I mean, you were the man interviewing Alan Masarak. Give us the headlines and the highlights. What's interesting about this story?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've covered this story quite a lot on both UC Today and CX Today, so I'm not going to go through all the nitty-gritty. But essentially, Avaya have emerged from Chapter 11 after quite a short process, 78 or so days, I think, a really, really quick process. Alan Masarak, to his credit, has actually been incredibly transparent and is being very communicative with partners, customers, analysts like Zeus in the room here as well, and others, which is fantastic to see. I guess the big question looming is, where do Avaya go from here? They've come out with a much stronger balance sheet than they went in with, for obvious reasons, and now it's time for Alan to maybe spend a bit of money, double down on a bit of innovation. And it's really, you know, where's he going to go and how's he going to restore that trust, not just with partners, which is where we met him at Channel Partners, but also with those customers as well. And what do you do if you're in an enterprise contact center right now with Avaya technology? You know, what side of the fence are you sitting on? Do you stick with, or do you migrate away? That's a, you know, it's a big question. So I'm going to go to Zeus. Zeus, I know you spoke to Alan as well. What's your take on Avaya, and where they go from here?
Yeah, you know, Avaya is lucky in that they've got this oddly loyal user base that, and as you go up market, companies become less adverse to change. Swapping out things like even a phone system or a contact center creates incredible disruption. So as long as you can provide a path forward, a lot of those big companies that Avaya has, right, top 10 governments, they're all the top 10 banks, things like that, they tend to stick with them. Now, with that being said, I think I don't want to minimize what Alan's done, because redoing the financial structure that quickly is pretty impressive. But in a lot of ways, the hard work begins now, right? I think the company had this big boat anchor. They could almost use an excuse for their lack of innovation. But now that the financial issues are behind him, and he's, you know, that 5-point checklist that he had, he's checked all those off, right? Now he's got to start executing. He needs a chief product officer. He needs a chief marketing officer. He needs a new CFO, right? So his executive bench is pretty, you know, devoid. He's got a whole new advisory board. I think it's fair to say they haven't done a lot of innovation over the last years. They did roll out the CCaaS product, but they've got some product integration issues because they've got a whole bunch of, you know, different products for different markets. And so from here, now it comes down to execution, right? Like executing on the business. He talks about innovation with disruption. You can't really do that without the innovation half of that, right? I guess, or it's, you know, lack of disruption from lack of innovation or something. But I do think right now he's got some tough decisions to make on who he wants for an executive bench, and that's going to determine what they do for product, because they are they still do have quite a mixed bag of different products that, you know, that serve different needs, and I think it creates an overly expensive model. On the good side, I know he did feel coming in the company, he did feel there's a lot of inefficiencies there. And he said, you know, he could add 1,000 people to the company, it wouldn't really increase revenues. Similarly, you could take out 1,000 people and it wouldn't really negatively impact revenues. And so I think he's got the organization right-sized. Now he's got to focus on hiring an executive team. And then, you know, it's going to come down to execution. If the company can execute and grow, they'll be fine. And if not, they're going to find themselves in the situation, you know, 5 years from now.
Absolutely. Is anyone else got any comments on where Avaya goes from this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing I'm keeping my eye on is they seem to be a pretty good acquisition target right now. You know, as I said, they have a loyal customer base. They've got a good set of products. They do well in the very complex, large-scale contact center. So if you think about, you know, a company that's a partner of theirs and investor in them, I guess at this point, RingCentral would, you know, potentially look at their balance sheet now and say, you know what, they're a lot more attractive. They get us into that larger enterprise. They give us that, you know, on-prem portfolio for again, those complex situations. I think that's going to be something interesting to watch. But I think, yeah, as I said, it's really, okay, you made it through bankruptcy. They've got really good at getting through bankruptcy quickly. The big question is, how do they grow from here?
Yeah, it really brings up a good point, because somebody did ask me that today. Is it more likely they acquire, or are they an acquisition target? And I think it's 50-50 on that. I do think, because they're install base and their lack of debt now, in this industry, you know, we've all been covering it for a long time. Acquiring customers is really hard. Install base is hard to move, right? Acquisition's the one way to do that quickly. And they have an install base that's covetable by everybody, really.
Shall we move on to our second bankruptcy story today? Rob, what have we got?
Yeah, this month we've got another bankruptcy story, and that's Lifesize. Unfortunately, went into Chapter 11, but was saved by Enghouse. So there's lots to this story, because there's a number of brands underneath within the Lifesize portfolio. But really interesting to hear kind of everyone's view on this. David, I mean, initially, kind of what were your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. This one's surprised me a little bit, but then again, this industry is full of surprises. We are in a time of more digital meetings than ever before. But of course, this is a market of great competition, and that doesn't guarantee, you know, your success just because you've got the right sort of technology. So LifeSize, obviously renowned for their meeting room technology, they have fallen into Chapter 11. Erwin, I believe you've got some opinions around this. There are lots of brands that kind of been acquired and picked out by various parties. I'll throw it over to Erwin now. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Incaus has become this collection point for legacy video vendors that have had really innovative technology. They acquired the assets of Video VIDYO a number of years ago. They've used that to build into their contact center portfolio for things like telehealth and customer engagement using video. I mentioned to one of my colleagues that LifeSize had been acquired, and the first response was, wow, I didn't know that they were still around. I mean, LifeSize has been around, really one of the early video conferencing vendors. They kind of missed the revolution that we saw around the pandemic and lost out to Zoom, who had a much easier to obtain, easier to use, more software-centric view application versus LifeSize was more traditionally focused around hardware and high-quality experiences. They were the first on the market with 4K video a few years ago. So, you know, from the Incaus perspective, they get the assets of LifeSize's contact center a product. They bought Serenova a number of years ago, LifeSize did. So now they bring the Serenova customer base over. They bring what's left of the LifeSize customer base over. I don't think this is going to be a massive growth engine for Incaus. The question, like we talked about with Avaya, is what do they do now? Where do they go? Can they harmonize their portfolio? We haven't seen Incaus as aggressive in the contact center space over the last few years as companies like Five9 and InContact and TalkDesk and TalkDesk. So hopefully they can take these assets, integrate them, and be able to deliver a set of products and features that can more help them more effectively compete in the cloud contact center and video space.
I think just to add to that, maybe not comment on LifeSize in general, but I think we're probably at the start of a number of businesses similar to LifeSize are going to be going through this process. I think the comm space in general is to some extent oversaturated with vendors. And I think there's a number of them that won't be surviving this over the next few years. We are seeing continued acquisitions and continued consolidation, especially in the MSP and channel space in North America and Europe as well. And I think it's kind of, this is now playing up to the vendor space at the end. There are a few viable options out there, and there's going to be some interesting assets coming up on the market over the next few years, which interesting companies will acquire and get some very good assets and capabilities through it.
Fantastic. So shall we move on to our final couple of topics for the day? We've got some workplace trends to discuss. Rob, what's on the agenda?
Yeah, so next story is an interesting one, which was Lucy Cooper, head of customer innovation for Europe at Microsoft, said workers should actively fight back against the movement to force them back to the office. And we all know there's a back to the office kind of thing happening, but it's interesting to see that kind of angle coming from an executive at Microsoft. But I think I'd just like to dig a little bit deeper on this kind of back to work trend and, you know, what the kind of, what's actually happening out there right now, and how do we see it playing out? What do you think, David?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. And also something just about every business that had to go remote during the pandemic is currently going through. How do we get people back in the office? Do we get people back in the office? If we get them back, how long do we get them back for? Full-time, part-time, and all the rest of it. So this coming from a senior exec at Microsoft was particularly interesting. Lucy's point was the negative impact that would have for women with child sort of care responsibilities and school runs, and also men that have to do those things as well. And of course, the younger generation who maybe prefer to work in that kind of remote scenario. So interestingly, Microsoft's current sort of model is about 50-50, 50% in the office, 50% remote, which to a lot of people doesn't sound like a bad kind of balance, but I guess that depends on what your preferences are. For me, it's really about encourage versus force. And how do you get people back in if that's what you need? What's the encouraging factors to get them back in? And versus, do you need to force them to come back in? So I'm fascinated by this subject. I'm in the hybrid camp myself. I don't like being at home 100% of the time, but I don't like being in an office 100% of the time either. So I'll throw this over to Evan now. Evan, what are your thoughts on this sort of workplace trend we're seeing?
Well, I thought it was a fascinating read on UC Today, and I thought it raised so many important issues, not just about hybrid work, but about socioeconomic issues and the future of work. You mentioned the impact on women. You know, women bear the brunt of responsibility for caregiving and maintaining the household, all that sort of unpaid work. So it has, you know, the pandemic has had a disordinate amount of impact on women, but also young people who have very different needs and expectations of work than, you know, middle-aged workers like ourselves. So, you know, that was a huge topic. And I think there's a pretty big industry difference between the remote work acceptance and pushback. I mean, if you look at, I think what Zia said, around hybrid work in 2023, described it as a disaster, which is, you know, not overstating it. Companies don't know how to implement hybrid work. They don't really have formulated policies that really meet employee expectations. And they're not always, it's not always clear why that return to the office is necessary if you're going to sit on meetings all day. So there needs to be a lot more thought given to this whole area, making, you know, work a magnet versus a mandate. I mean, most of my career, I drove an hour to sit in a sort of dark cubicle most of the day. And clearly that scenario is just unattractive to Gen Zs and millennials. And, you know, it's very industry specific. I mean, the rush back to the office, the mandate, as it were, is being pushed by financial services and, you know, insurance companies and banking, you know, companies. And, you know, that's very different from tech, where I think we have a much more laissez-faire attitude. And, you know, most tech companies I talk to are fine with hybrid and or fully remote. So, you know, the big question is rethinking work, rethinking the purpose of not just the office, but the office space and what's needed, and how it can be more of a magnet to employees. I'd love to hear other folks' thoughts on that topic.
If I could step in there, I think Evan makes some really good points around that. I think the one thing I'd push back on, and it comes down to the demographic one, we ran a piece of research 2 months ago, 2,000 employees looking at different generations, how they want to work, where they want to work from. And we were fascinated with the results of it, that actually there's a lot of Gen Z who do want to go to the office. I think we forget that a lot of the younger generations go to the office, one, because they have a bad situation at home. They're usually working in a bedroom or something like that if they're working in a major city, because they're flat sharing, they don't have a good working environment. Two, they need to learn from people. There's a learning from osmosis, and there's a picking up pieces from different people in organization and mentorship that is not being done as well remotely. And thirdly, a lot of young people meet their friends and make friends at work. It's a great social environment for them to be in as well. And then being locked at home really isn't a benefit for them. And I speak from experience at Cavell. Over the pandemic, we hired 5 different graduates out, young people coming to their first job in London. And we're probably one of the only companies who was fully remote before the pandemic. We've never had an office. As the pandemic broke, we got an office. And in the last year, we've tripled the size of that office to make it so that people will come in, because we are a younger team. We're demanding that we had an office space to work in. So we've spent a lot of money doing that. We've made it sure that also we have no mandate for coming into the office or not. We don't care if you come in or you don't come in. Obviously, we have some days that we'd like people to come in because we're having a meeting and it'd be a better environment for everyone to be in. But we pay for all our if our team wants to come in, we'll pay for their travel in and out. So it's not a choice around it's expensive or it's a long way. And actually, yeah, our office is pretty much full every single day, apart from Mondays and Fridays, because no one wants to work those days from the office. But I think there's a definite shift in that. I think from a a wider point of view, especially walking around some of the major cities that all of us travel to going to these events, you do see that the center of town and the downtowns are slower than they used to be. There is a marked slowdown in the amounts of people going in, especially Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays in London, where compared to before the pandemic and now, there's a huge amount of businesses not doing that. Are we going to see the real estate crash at some point when people realize that a lot of these offices aren't being used? When we were looking for an office, we had companies contacting us saying, we've got thousands of square feet of office space that we're not using, but we've subcontracted for the next 5 years. When those all come to an end in the next 4 or 5 years, there is a lot of office space that is not going to be used. And I think that's going to have a real issue economically and at some point on society. So, I think it's a fascinating area. And I think if I'm giving advice to companies, it's don't force it, give them the option, but make sure the option is as good as it can be. And don't put any friction into them coming into the office.
Here's the thing. I really don't like blanket statements like that. They should just push back. I think where companies have struggled is if you're going to allow people to work remote, that's fine, but you need to put some rules in place. I talked to company after company where they say that when people are working from home, particularly Friday afternoons, they never respond to Slack, they never run email. I'm here at Dell Tech World, and I was talking with a company about that yesterday, one of the customers here, who said, when the younger people, especially when they're remote, they go shopping during the day and things like that. And I said, well, have you put any rules in place? Is there any expectations from the employees that they understand what's expected of them when they're not in the office? And most companies I talk to say no. So it's fine to have these policies or not have policies or whatever. But I do think as people come into the workforce, you need to set some expectations of how they should work and, what work activities. Work from home doesn't mean not working, right? I think without those rules in place, you leave it up to the individual to determine what that means for them. And that's where the problems arise.
In our research, we found about half of companies are forcing people to come back, requiring, I should say, maybe a kinder word. Roughly, that's evenly split between full-time in the office, part-time in the office. The biggest driver, obviously, aside from the fact that there are certain people in certain roles, as we talked about, who can't work from home due to the nature of their job, the biggest driver is that there's a belief that you have better informal collaboration. We've seen as exactly what Dominic talked about, where people are seeing that the younger workers want to be in the office. They need that mentor relationship. They want to establish those social relationships. And also that feeling that, if we can go out to lunch, we grab a cup of coffee together, we kind of build that bond. I've seen that research from the institute that Slack set up, I think it's called the Future Forum, that show that you can't be 100% remote. You have to have people coming and meeting with one another at least some portion of time so that they build those relationships. What we've done to address the issue that Zayas brought up in our organization, because we are 100% virtual, we've been that way since we started, is that we're not focusing on work as the number of hours that you're at your desk, but rather focused on what you do. So we have a complex established task management system. We look at what are people expected to do throughout the day. We give everybody the ability to block Fridays off. We don't do any phone calls on Friday unless they're absolutely urgent. But the rule is you have to be accessible. So if I ping you in Slack or I text you or something, I expect that within an hour, I'm going to get a response. And if you need to take the entire day off, that becomes a PTO day. So we see a lot of companies, kind of experimenting with those capabilities to give employees the flexibility. And we find that for companies that continue to support, whether it's hybrid work or full-time remote work, that it's giving employees that quality of life, ability to manage their schedules, ability to work around the schedules of their kids, to work the hours that work for them. Again, that doesn't work for everybody. If I'm part of a sales or a customer service team, obviously I can't say, I only want to work from, 8 p.m. to midnight because that works best for me. I have to be on when customers are calling in. But at least I think people need to get away from that scenario of work is just the time you spend at your desk. It's what you do. It's not the hours that you're putting in.
I think that's a challenge for companies, though, when they're looking at measuring their productivity. Is a lot of businesses measure what's the input? How much time are they putting into it? Are they at their desk from 9 to 5? as you say, you measure the output and suddenly your company becomes productive and employees are happy because they know if they get their work done, they've done their task in time. So I 100% agree, but I think there's a lot of people out there who are still managing on a, if they're not there from 9 to 5, that is a real issue. We don't think they're being productive.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject. And, you know, as a remote business ourselves, you know, we're going through these issues as well. And with the added dynamic of a potential 4-day work week as well, which a lot of businesses in the UK have kind of been trialing over the last year or so. So hopefully we'll have some more insights to share on this kind of workplace trend with you from our own experience soon enough. Rob, we do have a last question to get through. What have we got on the agenda?
Yeah, it's just a quick one here, and just keen to get some opinions on our latest opinion poll, which was I'm always interested in kind of gauging how the landscape's changing, how preferences are changing in terms of communication, collaboration needs, and that kind of thing. Certainly in the workplace. So we put a latest poll up on LinkedIn, and 600 LinkedIn professionals responded to the question: which communications method would you lose? And we put video, email, messaging, and voice as options. And it's the results that we're interested in. From 600 votes, 35% said video. That was the biggest or the majority of the votes. 32% said email. Well, I love hate email, but you know, email's got certainly got to go. And 18% said messaging, and 16%. So the one you wouldn't lose was actually voice. So does that mean voice is still king? Certainly does in this poll. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That would suggest voice is very much still the predominant channel. This surprised me. You know, video coming in at number one, the number one channel people would lose, and that really, really surprised me. We were chatting off screen earlier, and you know, I personally find it quite strange talking to someone now and not being able to visually see them, to read their expressions, their mood, and how they're reacting to what I'm saying. I actually struggle with normal voice calls. So that's kind of surprised me. I'm very much in the let's get rid of email. I could set fire to my inbox tomorrow and be quite happy with that. But alas, what does our panel think? Who's got some opinions on this? Should we start with Evan on that one?
Yeah, I think the challenge is not video per se, but it's the back-to-back never-ending stream of pun intended video meetings that are in our calendars all day, and the phenomenon of video fatigue, the psychological phenomenon, is real, and you just can't be overwhelmed by 8 hours of that kind of focus, that camera on you, without psychological impact. And I think, you know, we're overwhelmed by meetings in general. The problem is now we're overwhelmed by video meetings. And so there needs to be a much more thoughtful approach to those. And I think, you know, as far as email goes, I agree totally. The problem with email is it's not been impacted by all the revolution we've seen in collaboration tools and video tools and, you know, productivity tools. Email is still email. And it's still a, you know, a hot mess. And so I look forward to someone, you know, reinventing email. I mean, that would have a far bigger impact on our productivity, you know, in a meaningful way. There've been innovation around the edges. Maybe AI is going to come to the rescue and save us from our email inbox.
Yeah, I was definitely surprised to see the video was tops as what people would give up. I mean, we kind of go into every research study we do with this hypothesis that we've hit peak video, that people have kind of would like to not do as many video calls. I think to Evan's point, you know, it's tiring if you have back-to-back calls. We see companies doing things like putting in mandatory 15-minute blocks and having meeting-free times, meeting-free days. So, you know, you're not sitting on video, because video is obviously a more intensive way of meeting with people versus when you're on a phone call and maybe you can get up and walk around when you're on that call. But we haven't seen the decline in video. We saw more than 60% of companies that said video use has increased over the last year. We saw roughly 35% of companies now that say video is critical. We can't tolerate any downtime. We did see about 18% that said that they are dealing with video fatigue and they are addressing it in some of the ways we talked about, mostly through shorter meetings than the standard 1 hour block and meeting free blocks and so on. But, you know, it's interesting to see that folks, that was the biggest response that people said that they'd get rid of.
See, I hark back to our generational research we did a couple of months ago, and one of the questions was what communication channel is your preferred method to communicate at work? And the thing that came bottom was video. And we were surprised about that. It came through as well. And it's, even when we look at Gen Z and millennials who everyone goes, oh, they only want to use video. It's true. Within their personal life, they use video a lot more than any other generation. But in the work environment, they really don't like using it. Typically, it's a lot of pressure for them being on video calls. Again, back to where they are working. A lot of these people started using video calls when they were sat in their bedrooms during the pandemic. It wasn't a great environment for them. It didn't look professional for them to be on. It was a real pressure for them to be. So I'm not surprised that video came up quite low down. And yeah, we talked about all those, what you've mentioned, all those things like video fatigue, like the amount of meetings that we have to do. If you broke that out and said, well, do you not like being on video because you do too much of it or because it's not as useful as the other methods? I think that's something that we would be definitely interesting to look at. But again, when you look at different generations about how they use the phone as well, only 24% of Gen Z use their phone every day if they have a phone number, whereas that goes up to 62% for baby boomers. And it's a growth trajectory up like that, that the older you get, the more preferable a phone call is over a video call. And that's their preferred mean of it. So I think it's, again, different generations speaking different patterns on this. So I'm not surprised that video is so low down. And I think it also comes down a bit to everyone has their own preference of how they want to communicate. We see this in the contact center at the moment where we're bringing in multiple different channels, and the whole view is, well, if someone wants to contact you through this medium, allow them to do that. And I think that's going to shift more and more into the enterprise communications when communicating internally or externally as well.
Fantastic. So, in the interest of finishing our meeting before the end of the hour, so we don't get meeting fatigue, I think we should wrap up today's session. Before we go, though, Rob, there are some events coming up that everyone should really know about and be looking forward to. What have you got to share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are getting towards the summer period where things do slow down a little bit, but we've still got some pretty hot events to mention. So we've got Infocom coming up in June. So that's the 10th of June to the 16th in Orlando, Florida. We have CCW in Vegas, the big contact center event. That's June 19th to the 22nd. We have UC Awards 2023. So not so much an event you visit, more one that you click onto and watch or apply for, which the application deadline is the 9th of June. So we're really looking forward to that. And last but not least, a little bit further on towards September. So the first one kind of after the summer period that's very notable is UCX USA, which is their debut event in the USA. So that's UC Expo, as we know it here in the UK, actually launching a US event. So that's in Austin, Texas, September 13th to the 14th.
Fantastic. So some great insights there from our panel. Thank you so much to Dom, Zias, Evan and Erwin, and of course my co-host Rob. It's been a really great session and I hope you all enjoyed it. That's it from me. We'll see you next time.